Ampules remaining, 40. I come to consciousness in the pitch black, lying on my side on the floor of the box, my back to the wall. Amanda is pressed up close against me, our bodies contoured together, her head resting in the crook of my arm. I'm hungry and thirsty. I wonder how long I've slept. At least my ear has stopped bleeding. It's impossible to deny the reality of our helplessness. Aside from each other, this box is the only constant we have. A very tiny boat in the middle of a very large ocean. It's our shelter, our prison, our home. Carefully, I untangle us. Pulling off my hoodie, I fold it into a pillow and slide it under Amanda's head. She stirs but doesn't wake. I feel my way around to the door, knowing I shouldn't take the risk of breaking the seal. But I have to know what's out there, and the claustrophobia of the box is wearing on me. Turning the handle, I drag it slowly open. First sensation, the smell of evergreens. Shafts of sunlight slant down through a forest of closely spaced pine trees. In the near distance, a deer stands motionless, staring through its dark, wet eyes at the box. When I step outside, the deer bounds off soundlessly through the pines. The forest is startlingly quiet. Mist hovers over the pine needle floor. I walk out a little ways from the box and sit on a piece of ground in direct morning sun that feels warm and bright against my face. A breeze pushes through the tops of the trees. I catch a hint of wood smoke in the wind. From an open fire? A chimney? I wonder, who lives here? What sort of a world is this? I hear footsteps. Glancing back, I see Amanda coming toward me through the trees and register a pang of guilt. I almost got her killed in that last world. She isn't just here because of me. She's here because she saved me. Because she did a brave, risky thing. She sits beside me and turns her face to the sun. "How'd you sleep?" she asks. "Hard. Awful crick in my neck. You?"
"Sore all over."
She leans in close and studies my ear. "Bad?" I ask.
"No, the bullet just trimmed off part of your earlobe. I'll clean it up for you."
She hands me a liter of water we refilled in that futuristic Chicago, and I take a long sip that I wish would never end.
"You doing okay?" she asks.
I can't stop thinking about her, lying dead on our porch, and Charlie up in his room. We are so lost. Amanda says,
"I know it's hard, but the question you should be thinking about, we should both be thinking about, is why did you bring us to that world?"
All I wrote was, "I want to go home."
"Exactly, that's what you wrote, but you carried baggage through the door."
"What do you mean?"
"Isn't it obvious?"
"Obviously not."
"Your worst fear."
"That type of scenario isn't everyone's?"
"Maybe, but it's so perfectly yours, I'm surprised you don't see it."
"How is it perfectly mine?"
"Not just losing your family, but losing them to illness. The same way you lost your mother when you were 8 years old."
I look over at Amanda. "How'd you know that?"
"How do you think?"
Of course. She was Jason 2's therapist. She says,
"Watching his mother die was the defining event of his life. It played a critical part in why he never married, never had kids, why he sunk himself into work."
I believe it. There were moments, early on, when I considered running from Daniela. Not because I wasn't crazy about her, but because on some level, I was afraid of losing her. And I felt the same fear all over again when I found out she was pregnant with Charlie. Why would I seek out a world like that?
Why do people marry versions of their controlling mothers or absent fathers?
To have a shot at righting old wrongs, fixing things as an adult that hurt you as a child.
Maybe it doesn't make sense at a surface level, but the subconscious marches to its own beat. I happen to think that world taught us a lot about how the box works.
Passing the water back to her, I say, 40.
40 what?
40 ampules left. Half are yours. That gives us each 20 chances to get this right. What do you want to do?
I'm not sure. All I know at this point is that I'm not going back to my world.
So do you want to stay together, or is this goodbye?
I don't know how you feel, but I think we still need each other. I think maybe I can help you get home.
I lean back against the trunk of a pine tree, a notebook resting on my knees, my thoughts teeming. What a strange thing to consider, imagining a world into being with nothing but words, intention, and desire. It's a troubling paradox. I have total control, but only to the extent I have control over myself, my emotions, my inner storm, the secret engines that drive me. If there are infinite worlds, how do I find the one that is uniquely, specifically, mine? I stare at the page and begin to write down every detail of my Chicago that comes to mind. I paint my life with words. The sounds of the children in my neighborhood, walking to school together, their voices like a stream flowing over rocks, high and burbling. Graffiti on the faded white brick of a building 3 blocks from my house that was so artfully done, it was never painted over. I meditate on the intricacies of my home. The 4th step on the staircase that always creaks. The downstairs bathroom with the leaky faucet. The way my kitchen smells as coffee brews first thing in the morning. All the tiny, seemingly insignificant details upon which my world hangs. 11. Ampules remaining, 32. There's a theory in the field of aesthetics called the uncanny valley. It holds that when something looks almost like a human being, a mannequin, or a human-like robot, it creates revulsion in the observer. Because the appearance is so close to human, yet just off enough to evoke a feeling of uncanniness, of something that is both familiar and alien. It's a similar psychological effect as I walk the streets of this Chicago that's almost mine. I would take an apocalyptic nightmare any day. Crumbled buildings and gray wasteland don't hold a candle to standing on a corner I've passed 1,000 times and realizing that the street names are wrong. Or the coffee place, where I always stop to grab my morning triple shot Americano with soy, is a boutique wine shop instead. Or my house at 44 Eleanor Street is a brownstone inhabited by strangers. This is the 4th Chicago we've connected to since escaping that world of sickness and death. Each has been like this one, almost home. Night is imminent, and since we've taken 4 hits of the drug in fairly rapid succession with no recovery period, we decide for the first time not to return to the box. It's the same hotel in Logan Square where I stayed in Amanda's world. The neon sign is red instead of green, but the name is the same, Hotel Royale. And it's just as quirky, just as frozen in time, but in 1,000 insignificantly different ways. Our room has 2 double beds, and just like the last room I had here, it looks out onto the street. I set our plastic bags containing toiletries and thrift store clothes on the dresser beside the television. Any other time, I might have balked at this dated room that smells like cleaning product failing to cover up mildew and worse. Tonight, it feels like luxury. Pulling off my hoodie and undershirt, I say, I'm too gross to even have an opinion about this place. I toss them into the waste bin. Amanda laughs. You don't want to get into a who's more disgusting competition with me. I'm surprised they rented us a room at any price.
That might tell you something about the quality of establishment we're dealing with.
I go to the window, part the curtains. It's early evening. Raining. The exterior hotel sign bleeds red neon light into the room. I couldn't begin to guess the day or date. I say. Bathroom's all yours. Amanda grabs her things from the plastic bag. Soon, I can hear the bright sound of running water echoing off the tile. She calls out, "Oh my God, you have to take a bath, Jason. You have no idea." I'm too dirty to lie down on the bed, so I sit on the carpet next to the radiator, letting waves of heat wash over me and watching the sky darken through the window. I take Amanda's advice and draw a bath. Condensation runs down the walls. The heat works wonders on my lower back, which has been out for days from sleeping in the box. As I shave my beard, the questions of identity keep haunting me. There's no Jason Dessen employed as a physics professor at Lakemont College or any of the local schools, but I can't help wondering if I'm out there somewhere. In another city. Another country. Perhaps living under a different name, with a different woman, a different job. If I am, if I spend my days under broken-down cars in a mechanic's shop, or drilling cavities instead of teaching physics to college students, am I still the same man at the most fundamental level? And what is that level? If you strip away all the trappings of personality and lifestyle, what are the core components that make me, me? After an hour, I emerge, clean for the first time in days, wearing jeans, a plaid button-down, and an old pair of Timberlands. They're a half size too big, but I've doubled up on wool socks to compensate. Amanda studies me appraisingly, says, "Works." "Not so bad yourself." Her thrift store score consists of black jeans, boots, a white t-shirt, and a black leather jacket that still reeks of the prior owner's smoking habit. She's lying in bed, watching a TV show I don't recognize. She looks up at me. "Know what I'm thinking?" "What?" "Bottle of wine, ridiculous amount of food, every dessert on the menu. I mean, I haven't been this skinny since college." "The multiverse diet." She laughs, and it's a good thing to hear. We walk for 20 minutes in the rain, because I want to see if one of my favorite restaurants exists in this world. It does, and it's like running into a friend in a foreign city. This cozy, hipster place is a riff on an old Chicago neighborhood inn. There's a long wait for a table, so we stalk the bar until a pair of stools opens up, sliding in at the far end beside a rain-streaked window. We order cocktails, then wine. A thousand small plates that just keep coming. We catch a hard, beautiful glow off the booze, and our conversation stays very much in the moment. How the food is. How good it feels to be inside and warm. Neither of us mentions the box even once. Amanda says I look like a lumberjack. I tell her she looks like a biker chick. We both laugh too hard, too loud, but we need it. As she gets up to go to the bathroom, she says, "You'll be right here?" "I will not move from this spot." But she keeps looking back. I watch her walk down the bar and disappear around the corner. On my own, the ordinariness of the moment is almost too much to stand. I glance around the restaurant, taking in the faces of the waiters, the customers. 2 dozen noisy conversations mixing into a kind of meaningless roar. I think, what if you people knew what I knew? The walk back is colder and wetter. Near the hotel, I see the sign for my local bar, Village Tap, blinking across the street. I say, "Feel like a nightcap?" It's late enough that the bulk of the evening crowd has thinned out. We grab seats at the bar, and I watch as the bartender finishes updating someone's ticket at the touchscreen. He finally turns and comes over, looks at Amanda first, then me. It's Matt. He has probably served me 1,000 drinks in my lifetime. He served me and Ryan Holder my last night in my world. But there's no hint of recognition, just blank, disinterested courtesy. "What can I get you guys?" Amanda orders a wine. I ask for a beer.
As he pulls the tap, I lean over and whisper to Amanda. I know the bartender. He doesn't recognize me.
What do you mean you know him?
This is my local bar.
No, it's not. And of course he doesn't recognize you. What'd you expect?
It's just weird. This place looks exactly like it should. Matt brings our drinks over.
Want to start a tab?
I have no credit card, no identification. Nothing but a roll of cash in the inner pocket of my members-only jacket right next to our remaining ampules. I'll just settle up now. As I reach for the money, I say, I'm Jason, by the way.
Matt.
I like this place. Yours?
Yep.
He seems not to give a single fuck what I think of his bar, and it puts a sad, hollow feeling in the pit of my stomach. Amanda senses. When Matt leaves us, she lifts her wine glass and clinks it against my pint. Says, to a good meal, a warm bed, and not being dead yet. Back in the hotel room, we kill the lights and get undressed in the dark. I know I've lost all objectivity with regard to our accommodations, because the bed feels wonderful. Amanda asks from her side of the room,
you locked the door?
I did. I close my eyes. I can hear the rain ticking against the window, the occasional car moving past on the wet street below.
It was a nice night, Amanda says.
It was. I don't miss the box, but it's strange being away from it.
I don't know about you, but my old world is feeling more and more like a ghost. You know how a dream feels the farther you get from it? It loses its color and intensity and logic. Your emotional connection to it fades.
I ask, you think you'd ever forget it entirely? Your world?
I don't know. I could see it getting to the point where it didn't feel real anymore. Because it isn't. The only thing that's real in this moment is this city, this room, this bed, you and me.
In the middle of the night, I realize Amanda is beside me. It's nothing totally new. We've slept like this in the box many times, holding each other in darkness, as lost as two people have ever been. The only difference now is that we're wearing nothing but our underwear, and her skin is distractingly soft against mine. Shivers of neon light slip through the curtains. Reaching over in the darkness, she takes hold of my hand and puts it around her. Then she turns over, faces me.
You're a better man than he ever was.
Who?
The Jason I knew.
I hope so. Jesus. I smile to flag the joke. She just stares at me with these midnight eyes. We've looked at each other a lot lately, but there's something different in the way she's looking at me now. There's a connection here, and it's getting stronger every day. If I moved even an inch closer in her direction, we would do this, no question in my mind. And if I did kiss her, if we slept together, maybe I'd feel guilty and regret it, or maybe I'd realize that she could make me happy. Some version of me certainly kissed her in this moment. Some version knows the answer, but it won't be me. She says,
if you want me to go back over there, just say it.
I say, I don't want you to, but I need you to. Ampules remaining, 24. Yesterday, I saw myself on the Lakemont campus in a world where Daniela had died, according to an obituary I found online at the public library, at 33 from brain cancer. Today, it's a gorgeous afternoon in a Chicago where Jason Dessen died 2 years ago in a car accident. I step into an art gallery in Bucktown, trying not to look at the woman behind the counter whose nose is in a book. Instead, I focus on the walls, which are covered in oil paintings whose subject appears to be exclusively Lake Michigan. In every season, every color, every time of day. The woman says without looking up,
Let me know if there's anything I can help you with.
Are you the artist?
She sets the book aside and steps out from behind the register. Walks over. It's the closest I've been to Daniela since the night I helped her die. She's stunning. Form-fitting jeans and a black t-shirt splattered with acrylic paint.
I am, yes, Daniela Vargas.
She clearly doesn't know me, doesn't recognize me. I guess in this world, we never met. Jason Dessen. She offers her hand, and I take it. It feels just like hers, rough and strong and adept, the hand of an artist. Paint is stuck to her fingernails. I can still feel them running down my back. These are amazing, I say.
Thank you.
I love the focus on one subject.
I started painting the lake 3 years ago. It's so different season to season.
She points to the one we're standing in front of.
This was one of my first attempts. That's from Juneway Beach in August. On clear days in late summer, the water turns this luminescent greenish blue, almost tropical.
She moves down the wall.
Then you get a day like this in October, all clouded over, and it paints the water gray. I love these because there's almost no distinction between the water and the sky.
You have a favorite season? I ask.
Winter.
Really?
It's the most diverse, and the sunrises are spectacular. When the lake froze over last year, those are some of my best paintings.
How do you work? En plein air or...
From photographs mainly. I occasionally set up my easel on the shore in the summer, but I love my studio so much, I rarely paint elsewhere.
The conversation stalls. She glances back at the register, wanting to get back to her book, probably. Having most likely made an appraisal of my faded thrift store jeans and hand-me-down button-down, and realized I'm unlikely to buy anything.
Is this your gallery? I ask. Though I know the answer.
Just wanting to hear her talk, to make this moment last as long as it possibly can.
It's actually a co-op, but since my work is hanging this month, I'm on deck to hold down the fort.
She smiles, only politely. Begins to drift away.
If there's anything else I can...
I just think you're so talented.
Oh, that's really nice of you to say. Thank you.
My wife is an artist.
Local?
Yep.
What's her name?
It's, well, you probably wouldn't know it, and we're not really together anymore, so.
Sorry to hear that.
I reach down and touch the frayed thread that's still, against all odds, tied around my ring finger. It's not that we're not together, it's just... I don't finish the thought, because I want her to ask me to finish it, to show a shred of interest. Stop looking at me like a stranger, because we are not strangers.
We've made a life together. We have a son. I've kissed every inch of your body. I've cried with you and laughed with you.
How can something so powerful in one world not bleed through into this one? I stare into Daniela's eyes, but there's no love or recognition or familiarity coming back. She just looks mildly uncomfortable. Like she's hoping I'll leave.
Do you want to get a cup of coffee? I ask.
She smiles, now severely uncomfortable. I mean, after you get off, whenever that is. If she says yes, Amanda will kill me. I'm already late meeting her back at the hotel. We're supposed to return to the box this afternoon. But Daniela isn't going to say yes. She's biting her lip like she always does when she's nervous. No doubt trying to come up with some reason beyond a blanket, ego-destroying,
no.
But I can see she's drawing a blank, that she's working up the nerve to drop the hammer on my foundering ass.
You know what? I say. Never mind. I'm sorry. I've put you on the spot.
Fuck. I'm dying. It's one thing to get shot down by a total stranger. Another entirely to crash and burn with the mother of your child.
I'm just going to go now.
I head for the door. She doesn't try to stop me. Ampules remaining, 16. Every Chicago we've stepped into this last week, the trees are looking more and more skeletal, their leaves stripped and rain-pasted to the pavement. I sit on the bench across the street from my brownstone, bundled up against the bitter morning cold in a thrift store coat I bought yesterday for $12 with currency from another world. It smells like an old man's closet, mothballs and analgesic cream. Back at the hotel, I left Amanda scribbling away in a notebook of her own. I lied, told her I was going out for a walk to clear my head and get a cup of coffee. I see myself step out the front door and move quickly down the steps and onto the sidewalk, heading for the L station, where I'll take the purple line to the Lakemont campus in Evanston. I'm wearing noise-canceling headphones, probably listening to a podcast, some science lecture, or an episode of This American Life. It's October 30th, according to the front page of the Tribune, a little less than a month since the night I was taken at gunpoint and ripped out of my world. Feels like I've been traveling in the box for years. I don't know how many Chicagos we've connected to so far. They're all beginning to blend. This one is the closest yet, but it still isn't mine. Charlie attends a charter school, and Daniela works out of the house as a graphic designer. Sitting here, I realize I've always looked at Charlie's birth and my choice to make a life with Daniela as the threshold event that caused the trajectory of our lives to swing away from success in our careers. But that's an oversimplification. Yes, Jason too walked away from Daniela and Charlie and subsequently had the breakthrough. But there are a million Jasons who walked away and didn't invent the box. Worlds where I left Daniela and our careers still amounted to nothing. Or where I left and we both found moderate levels of success, but failed to set the world on fire. And inversely, there are worlds where I stayed and we had Charlie, which branched into less than perfect timelines, where our relationship deteriorated, where I decided to leave our marriage, or Daniela did. Or we struggled and suffered along in a loveless and broken state, toughing it out for the sake of our son. If I represent the pinnacle of family success for all the Jason Dessens, Jason too represents the professional and creative apex. We're opposite poles of the same man, and I suppose it isn't a coincidence that Jason too sought out my life from the infinite possibilities available. Though he'd experienced complete professional success, total fulfillment as a family man was as foreign to him as his life was to me. It all points to the fact that my identity isn't binary. It's multifaceted. And maybe I can let go of the sting and resentment of the path not taken, because the path not taken isn't just the inverse of who I am. It's an infinitely branching system that represents all the permutations of my life between the extremes of me and Jason too. Reaching into my pocket, I take out the prepaid mobile phone that cost $50, money that could have fed Amanda and me for a day or put us up in a cheap motel for another night. With my fingerless gloves, I uncrumple the torn-out sheet of yellow paper from the D section of the Chicago Metro phone book and dial the circled number. There's something horribly lonely about a place that's almost home. From where I sit, I can see the room on the second floor that I assume serves as Daniela's in-home office. The blinds are open, and she's seated with her back to me, facing a giant monitor. I see her lift a cordless handset and stare at the display, not recognizing the number. Please answer. She shelves the phone. My voice. You've reached the Dessens. We can't take your call, but if you... I hang up before the beep. Call again. This time she picks up and answers before the second ring. Hello? For a moment, I don't say anything, because I can't find my voice. Hello? Hi. Jason? Yeah. What number are you calling from? I suspected she would ask this right off the bat. I say,
My phone's dead, so I borrowed one off this woman on the train.
Is everything okay?
How's your morning going? I ask.
Fine. I just saw you, silly.
I know. She spins around on the swivel chair at her desk, says,
So you just wanted to talk to me so badly that you borrowed a stranger's phone?
I did, actually.
You're sweet.
I just sit there, absorbing her voice. Daniela?
Yes?
I really miss you.
What's wrong, Jason?
Nothing.
You sound weird. Talk to me.
I was walking to the L and it just hit me.
What did?
I take so many moments with you for granted. I walk out the door to work, and I'm already thinking about my day, about the lecture I have to give, whatever, and I had a moment of clarity getting on the train about how much I love you, how much you mean to me, because you never know.
Never know what?
When it could all be taken away. Anyway, I tried to call you, but my phone was dead. For a long moment, there's just silence on the other end of the line. Daniela?
I'm here. And I feel the same way about you. You know that, right?
I close my eyes against the emotion, thinking I could cross the street right now and come inside and tell you everything. I am so lost, my love. Daniela steps down off her chair and walks over to the window. She's wearing a long, cream-colored sweater over yoga pants. Her hair is up, and she's holding a mug of what I suspect is tea from a local shop. She cradles her belly, which is rounded with child. Charlie is going to be a big brother. I smile through the tears, wondering what he thinks of that. It's something my Charlie missed.
Jason, are you sure everything's okay?
Positive.
Well, look, I'm on a deadline for this client, so...
You have to go.
I do.
I don't want her to. I need to keep hearing her voice.
Jason?
Yes?
I love you very much.
I love you too. You have no idea.
I'll see you tonight.
No, you'll see a very lucky version of me who has no clue how good he has it. She hangs up. Goes back to her desk. I return the phone to my pocket, shivering, my thoughts running in mad directions toward dark fantasies. I see the train I'm riding into work derailing, my body mangled beyond recognition, or never found. I see myself stepping into this life. It isn't mine exactly, but maybe it's close enough. In the evening, I'm still sitting on the bench on Eleanor Street, across from the brownstone that isn't mine, watching our neighbors arrive home from work and school. What a miracle it is to have people to come home to every day. To be loved. To be expected. I thought I appreciated every moment, but sitting here in the cold, I know I took it all for granted. And how could I not? Until everything topples, we have no idea what we actually have, how precariously and perfectly it all hangs together. The sky darkens. Up and down the block, the houses light up. Jason comes home. I'm in a bad way. Haven't eaten all day. Water hasn't touched my lips since morning. Amanda must be losing her mind, wondering where I am, but I can't drag myself away. My life, or at least a devastating approximation of it, is unfolding right across the street. It's long after midnight when I unlock the door to our hotel room. The lights are on, the television blaring. Amanda climbs out of bed, wearing a t-shirt and pajama bottoms. I close the door softly behind me. I say, I'm sorry.
You asshole.
I had a bad day.
You had a bad day.
Amanda, charging toward me, she shoves me with both hands as hard as she can, sending me crashing back into the door. She says,
I thought you left me. Then I thought something had happened to you. I had no way to get in touch with you. I started calling hospitals, giving them your physical description.
I would never just leave you.
How am I supposed to know that? You scared me.
I'm sorry, Amanda.
Where have you been?
She has me boxed in against the door. I just sat on this bench across the street from my house all day.
All day? Why?
I don't know.
That isn't your house, Jason. That isn't your family.
I know that.
Do you?
I also followed Daniela and Jason on a date.
What do you mean you followed them?
I stood outside the restaurant where they ate. The shame hits me as I say the words. I push past Amanda into the room, take a seat on the end of my bed. She comes over and stands in front of me. I say, they went to a movie after. I followed them inside, sat behind them in the theater.
Oh, Jason.
I did something else stupid.
What?
I used some of our money to buy a phone.
Why did you need a phone?
So I could call Daniela and pretend to be her Jason. I brace for Amanda to lose it again. But instead, she steps toward me and cradles my neck and kisses the top of my head.
Stand, she says.
Why?
Just do what you're told.
I rise. She unzips my jacket and helps slide my arms out of the sleeves. Then she pushes me back onto the bed and kneels, unlaces my boots, pries them off my feet, and tosses them into the corner. I say, for the first time, I think I understand how the Jason you knew might have done what he did to me. I'm having some fucked up thoughts.
Our minds aren't built to handle this. Seeing all these different versions of your wife, I can't even imagine.
He must have followed me for weeks, to work, on date nights with Daniela. He probably sat on that same bench and watched us moving through our house at night, imagining me out of the picture. Do you know what I almost did tonight?
What?
She looked scared to hear. I figure they probably keep their spare key in the same place we keep it. I left the movie early. I was going to find the key and let myself inside the house. I wanted to hide in a closet and watch their life, watch them sleep. It's sick, I know. And I know your Jason was probably in my house multiple times before the night he finally worked up the nerve to steal my life.
But you didn't do it.
No.
Because you're a decent man.
I don't feel very decent right now. I fall back onto the mattress and stare up at the ceiling of this hotel room that, in all its inconsequential permutations, has become our home away from the box. Amanda crawls onto the bed beside me.
This isn't working, Jason.
What do you mean?
We're just spinning our wheels.
I don't agree. Look where we started. Remember that first world we stepped into, with the buildings crashing down all around us?
I've lost count of how many Chicagos we've been to. We're not getting closer, Jason. The world you're looking for is a grain of sand on an infinite beach.
That's not true.
You've seen your wife murdered, die of a horrible disease. You've seen her not recognize you, married to other men, married to multiple versions of you. How much more of this can you take before you suffer a psychotic break? It's not that far off from your current mental state.
It's not about what I can take or can't take. It's about finding my Daniela.
Really? That's what you're doing, sitting on a bench all day? Looking for your wife?
Look at me.
We have 16 ampules left. We're running out of chances.
My head is pounding, spinning.
Jason.
I feel her hands on my face now.
You know what the definition of insanity is?
What?
Doing the same thing again and again, and expecting different results.
Next time,
what? Next time we'll find your home? How? You going to fill another notebook tonight? Would it make a difference if you did?
She lays her hand on my chest.
Your heart is going crazy. You have to calm down.
Rolling over, she turns off the lamp on the table between the beds. Lies down beside me, but there's nothing sexual about her touch. My head feels better with the lights off. The only illumination in the room is the blue neon light from the sign outside the window, and it's late enough that the passing cars on the street below are few and far between. Sleep is riding in, mercifully. I shut my eyes, thinking of the 5 notebooks stacked on my bedside table. Almost every page is filled with increasingly manic scrawl. I keep thinking if I write enough, if I'm specific enough, that I'll capture a full enough picture of my world to finally take me home. But it's not happening. Amanda isn't wrong. I'm looking for a grain of sand on an infinite beach.
12. In the morning, Amanda is no longer beside me. I lie on my side, watching the sunlight push through the blinds, listening to the noise of traffic humming through the walls. The clock is behind me on the bedside table. I can't see the time, but it feels late. We've slept in. I sit up, throw back the covers, look over at Amanda's bed. It's empty. Amanda? I start quickly toward the bathroom to see if she's in there, but what I see on top of the dresser makes me stop. Some cash, a few coins, 8 ampules, and a piece of paper ripped out of a notebook, covered in Amanda's handwriting.
Jason, after last night, it was clear to me that you've made a decision to go down a path I can't follow. I struggled with this all night. As your friend, as a therapist, I want to help you. I want to fix you. But I can't. And I can't keep watching you fall down, especially if I'm part of the reason you keep falling down. To what extent is our collective subconscious driving our connections to these worlds? It's not that I don't want you to get back to your wife. I want nothing more. But we've been together now for weeks. It's hard not to get attached, especially under these circumstances, when you're all I have. I read your notebooks yesterday, when I was wondering if you'd left me. And honey, you're missing the point. You're writing down all these things about your Chicago, but not what you feel. I've left you the backpack, half the ampules, and half the money, a whopping $161 in change. I don't know where I'll end up. I'm curious and scared, but excited too. There's a part of me that really wants to stay, but you need to choose your own next door to open. So do I. Jason, I wish you nothing but happiness. Be safe. Amanda.
Ampules remaining. 7. By myself, the full horror of the corridor sinks in. I have never felt so alone. There's no Daniela in this world. Chicago feels wrong without her. I hate everything about it. The color of the sky seems off. The familiar buildings mock me. Even the air tastes like a lie. Because it isn't my city. It's ours.
Ampules remaining. 6. I'm striking out. All night, I walk the streets alone, dazed, afraid, letting my system purge the drug. I eat at an all-night diner and ride the train back to the south side at dawn. On my way to the abandoned power plant, 3 teenagers see me. They're on the other side of the road, but at this hour, the streets are empty. They call out to me. Taunts and slurs. I ignore them, walk faster. But I know I'm in trouble when they start across the street, purposefully moving in my direction. For a moment, I consider running, but they're young and no doubt faster. Besides, it occurs to me as my mouth runs dry and the fight or flight response kicks an initial dump of adrenaline into my system that I may need my strength. On the outskirts of a neighborhood, where the row houses end and a train yard begins, they catch up to me. There's no one else out at this hour. No help in sight. They're even younger than I first thought, and the smell of malt liquor wafts off them like malicious cologne. The ragged energy they carry in their eyes suggests they've been out all night, perhaps searching for this exact opportunity. The beating begins in earnest. They don't even bother talking shit. I'm too tired, too broken to fight back. Before I even know what's happening, I'm down on the pavement, getting kicked in the stomach, the back, the face. I black out for a moment, and when I come to, I can feel their hands running up and down my body, searching, I assume, for a wallet that isn't there. They finally rip my backpack away, and as I bleed on the pavement, take off, laughing and running down the street. I lie there for a long time, listening to the volume of traffic steadily increase. The day grows brighter. People walk past me on the sidewalk without stopping. Each breath drives a wedge of pain between my bruised ribs, and my left eye is swollen shut. After a while, I manage to sit up. Shit. The ampules. Using a chain-link fence, I drag myself onto my feet. Please. I snake my hand up the inside of my shirt, my fingers grazing the piece of duct tape that's affixed to my side. It hurts like hell to peel it slowly back, but everything hurts like hell. The ampules are still there, 3 crushed, 3 intact. I stumble back into the box and shut myself inside. My money is gone. My notebooks are gone, my syringes and needles. I have nothing but my broken body and 3 more chances to get this right. Ampules remaining, 2. I spend the first half of the day begging on a south side street corner for enough money to catch a train into the city. I spend the rest of it 4 blocks from my brownstone, sitting on the pavement behind a cardboard sign that reads, "Homeless, desperate, anything helps." The condition of my battered face must go a long way toward garnering sympathy, because I collect $28.15 by the time the sun goes down. I'm hungry, thirsty, and sore. I choose a diner that looks shitty enough to have me, and as I pay for my meal, the exhaustion hits. I have nowhere to go. No money for a motel room. Outside, the night has turned cold and rainy. I walk to my house and head around the block to the alley, thinking of a place where I might sleep undisturbed, undetected. There's a space between my garage and the neighbors that's hidden behind the trash can and recycling bin. I crawl between them, taking with me a flattened box, which I lean against the wall of my garage. Underneath it, I listen to the rain pattering on the cardboard above my head, hoping my makeshift shelter will last the night. From my vantage point, I can see over the high fence that encircles my backyard, through a window, into the second floor of my house. It's the master bedroom. Jason walks past. It isn't Jason, too. I know for a fact this isn't my world. The stores and restaurants down the block from my house are wrong. These Dessens own different cars than my family, and he's heavier than I've ever been. Daniela appears for a moment in the window, reaches up, pulls the blinds closed. Good night, my love. The rain intensifies. The box sags. I begin to shiver. My 8th day on the streets of Logan Square, Jason Dessen himself drops a $5 bill into my collection box. There's no danger. I'm unrecognizable. Sunburned and bearded and reeking of abject poverty. The people in my neighborhood are generous. Every day I make enough to eat a cheap meal each evening and pocket a few dollars. Every night I sleep in the alley behind 44 Eleanor Street. It becomes a kind of game. When the lights in the master bedroom cut out, I close my eyes and imagine I'm him.
with her. Some days, I feel my sanity slipping. Amanda once said that her old world had begun to feel like a ghost, and I think I know what she means. We associate reality with the tangible, everything we can experience with our senses. And though I keep telling myself there's a box on the south side of Chicago that can take me to a world where I have everything I want and need, I no longer believe that place exists. My reality, more and more every day, is this world, where I have nothing, where I'm a homeless, filthy creature whose existence evokes only compassion, pity, and disgust. Nearby, another homeless man is standing in the middle of the sidewalk, having a full-volume conversation with nobody. I think, am I so different? Aren't we both lost in worlds that, for reasons beyond our control, no longer align with our identity? The most frightening moments are those that seem to be arriving with increasing frequency, moments where the idea of a magic box, even to me, sounds like the ravings of a crazy person. One night, I pass a liquor store and realize I have enough money for a bottle of something. I drink an entire pint of J&B, find myself standing in the master bedroom of 44 Eleanor Street, staring down at Jason and Daniela, asleep in their bed under a tangle of blankets. The bedside table clock shows 3:38 a.m., and though the house is dead silent, I'm so drunk I can feel my pulse beating against my eardrum. I can't piece together the thought process that brought me here. All I can think is that I had this, once upon a time, this beautiful dream of a life. And in this moment, with the room spinning and tears streaking down my face, I actually don't know if that life of mine was real or imagined. I take a step toward Jason's side of the bed, my eyes beginning to adjust in the darkness. He sleeps peacefully. I want what's his so badly I can taste it. I'd do anything to have his life, to step into his shoes. I imagine killing him, choking the life out of him, or shooting a bullet into his brain. I see myself trying to be him, trying to accept this version of Daniela as my wife, this Charlie as my son. Would this house ever feel like mine? Could I sleep at night? Could I ever look Daniela in the eyes and not think about the fear in her real husband's face 2 seconds before I took his life? No. No. Clarity comes crashing, painful, shameful, but in the exact moment when it's so desperately needed. The guilt and all the tiny differences would transform my life here into hell, into a reminder not just of what I'd done, but of what I still didn't have. This would never feel like my world. I'm not capable of this. I don't want this. I am not this man. I shouldn't be here. As I stumble out of the bedroom and down the hall, I realize that to have even considered this was to give up on finding my Daniela. To say I'm letting her go. That she isn't attainable. And maybe that's true. Maybe I don't have a prayer of ever finding my way back to her and Charlie and my perfect world. To that single grain of sand on an infinite beach. But I still have 2 ampules left, and I won't stop fighting until they're gone. I go to a thrift store and buy new clothes, jeans, flannel shirt, a black peacoat. Then toiletries at a drugstore, along with a notebook, pack of pens, and a flashlight. I check into a motel, throw my old clothes away, and take the longest shower of my life. The water running off my body is gray. Standing in front of the mirror, I look almost like myself again, though my cheekbones stand out with more prominence from malnutrition. I sleep into the afternoon and then train down to the south side. The power plant is quiet, sunlight slanting through the windows of the generator room. Sitting in the doorway of the box, I open the notebook. I've been thinking ever since I woke up about what Amanda said in her goodbye note, how I haven't really written about what I feel. Here goes. I'm 27 years old. I've worked all morning at the lab, and things are going so well, I almost shrug off the party. I've been doing that a lot lately, neglecting friends and social engagements to steal just a few more hours in the clean room. I first notice you in the far corner of the small backyard as I stand on the deck, sipping a Corona and lime, my thoughts still back at the lab. I think it's the way you're standing that catches my attention. Boxed in by a tall, lanky guy in tight black jeans, who I recognize from this circle of friends. He's an artist or something. I don't even know his name. Only that my friend Kyle has said to me recently, "Oh, that guy fucks everyone." I can't explain it, even to this day. But as I watch him chatting up this dark-haired, dark-eyed woman in a cobalt blue dress, you, a flash of jealousy consumes me. Inexplicably, insanely, I want to hit him. Something in your body language suggests discomfort. You aren't smiling, your arms are crossed, and it occurs to me that you're trapped in a bad conversation, and that for some reason, I care. You hold an empty wine glass, streaked with the dregs of a red. Part of me urges, "Go talk to her. Save her." The other half screams, "You know nothing about this woman, not even her name. You are not that guy." I find myself moving toward you through the grass, carrying a new glass of wine, and when your eyes avert to mine, it feels like some piece of machinery has just seized in my chest, like worlds colliding. As I draw near, you take the glass out of my hand, as if you had previously sent me off to get it, and smile with an easy familiarity, like we've known each other forever. You try to introduce me to Dylan, but the skinny-jeaned artist, now effectively cock-blocked, makes his excuses and bails. Then it's just the two of us standing in the shade of the hedgerow, and my heart is going like mad. I say, "I'm sorry to interrupt, but it looked like you might need rescuing." And you say, "Good instincts. He's pretty, but insufferable." I introduce myself. You tell me your name. Daniela. Daniela. I only remember pieces of what was said in our first moments together. Mainly how you laugh when I tell you I'm an atomic physicist, but not derisively. As if the revelation truly delights you. I remember how the wine had stained your lips. I've always known, on a purely intellectual level, that our separateness and isolation are an illusion. We're all made of the same thing, the blown-out pieces of matter formed in the fires of dead stars. I've just never felt that knowledge in my bones until that moment, there, with you. And it's because of you. Yes, maybe I just want to get laid, but I also wonder if this sense of entanglement might be evidence of something deeper. This line of thinking I wisely keep to myself. I remember the pleasant buzz from the beer and the warmth of the sun, and then, as it begins to drop, realizing how badly I want to leave this party with you, but not having the balls to ask. And then you say, "I have a friend whose gallery opening is tonight. Want to come?" And I think, I will go anywhere with you. Ampules remaining. 1. I walk the infinite corridor, the beam of my flashlight glancing off the walls. After a while, I stop in front of a door like all the rest. 1 in a trillion, trillion, trillion. My heart is racing, my palms sweating. There is nothing else I want, just my Daniela. I want her in a way I can't explain, that I don't ever want to be able to explain, because the mystery of it is a perfect thing. I want the woman I saw at that backyard party all those years ago. the one I chose to make a life with, even though it meant giving up some other things I loved. I want her, nothing more. I draw in a breath. I let it out, and I open the door. 13. Snow from a recent storm has dusted the concrete and coated the generators beneath those glassless upper windows. Even now, flurries blow in off the lake, drifting down like cold confetti. I wander away from the box, trying to temper my hope. This could be an abandoned power plant in South Chicago in any number of worlds. As I move slowly down the row of generators, a glint on the floor catches my eye. I approach. Resting in a crack in the concrete 6 inches from the base of the generator, an empty ampule with its neck snapped off. In all the abandoned power plants I've passed through during this last month, I've never seen this. Perhaps the one Jason 2 injected himself with seconds before I lost consciousness, on the night he stole my life. I hike out of the industrial ghost town, hungry, thirsty, exhausted. The skyline looms to the north, and even though it's decapitated by the low winter clouds, it's unmistakably the one I know. I board the northbound red line at 87th Street as dusk is falling. There are no seatbelts, no holograms on this L. Just a slow, rickety ride through South Chicago. Then the urban sprawl of downtown. I switch trains. The blue line carries me into the gentrified northern neighborhoods. Over the last month, I've been in Chicago's that looked similar, but there's something different about this one. It isn't just that empty ampule. It's something deeper that I can't explain other than to say, it feels like a place where I belong. It feels like mine. As we cruise past gridlocked rush hour traffic on the expressway, the snow intensifies. I wonder, is Daniela, my Daniela, alive and well under the snow-laden clouds? Is my Charlie breathing the air of this world? I exit the train onto the L platform in Logan Square and thrust my hands deep into the pockets of my coat. Snow is sticking to the familiar streets of my neighborhood, to the sidewalks, to the cars parked along the curbs. The headlight beams from rush hour traffic slash through the profusion of snowflakes. Up and down my block, the houses stand glowing and lovely in the storm. A fragile half inch has already collected on the steps to my porch, where a single set of footprints leads to the door. Through the front window of the brownstone, I see the lights on inside, and from where I stand on the sidewalk, this looks exactly like home. I keep expecting to discover that some minor detail is off. The wrong front door, the wrong street number, a piece of furniture on the stoop I don't recognize. But the door is right. The street number is right. There's even a tesseract chandelier hanging above the dinner table in the front room, and I'm close enough to see the large photograph on the mantel. Daniela, Charlie, and me at Inspiration Point in Yellowstone National Park. Through the open doorway that leads from the dining room into the kitchen, I glimpse Jason standing at the island, holding a bottle of wine. Reaching across, he pours into someone's wine glass. Elation hits, but it doesn't last. From my vantage point, all I can see is a beautiful hand holding the stem of the glass. And it crashes down on me again what this man did to me. All that he took, everything he stole. I can't hear anything out here in the snow, but I see him laugh and take a sip of wine. What are they talking about? When was the last time they fucked? Is Daniela happier now than she was a month ago with me? Can I stand to know the answer to that question? The sane, even voice in my head is wisely suggesting that I move away from the house right now. I'm not ready to do this. I have no plan, only rage and jealousy. And I shouldn't get ahead of myself. I still need more confirmation
that this is my world. A little ways down the block, I see the familiar back end of our Suburban. Walking over, I brush off the snow that's clinging to the Illinois tag. The license plate number is mine. The paint is the right color. I clear the back windshield. The purple Lakemont Lions decal looks perfect, inasmuch as it's half ripped off. I instantly regretted putting the sticker on the glass the moment I did it. Tried to tear it off, but only managed to remove the top half of the lion's face, so all that's left is a growling mouth. But that was 3 years ago. I need something more recent, more definitive. Several weeks before I was abducted, I accidentally backed the Suburban into a parking meter near campus. It didn't do much damage beyond cracking the right rear taillight and denting in the bumper. I wiped the snow off the red plastic of the taillight and then the bumper. I touched the crack. I touched the dent. No other Suburban in the countless Chicagos I've visited has borne these markings. Rising, I glance across the street toward that bench where I once spent an entire day watching another version of my life unfold. It's empty at the moment, the snow piling up silently on the seat. Shit. A few feet behind the bench, a figure watches me through the snowy darkness. I begin walking quickly down the sidewalk, thinking it probably looked as if I were stealing the license plate off the Suburban. I have to be more careful. The blue neon sign in the front window of Village Tap blinks through the storm like a signal from a lighthouse telling me I'm close to home. There is no Hotel Royale in this world, so I check into the sad Days Inn across from my local bar. Two nights is all I can afford, and it brings my cash reserves down to $120 and change. The business center is a tiny room down the hallway on the first floor, with a borderline obsolete desktop, fax machine, and printer. Online, I confirm three pieces of information. Jason Dessen is a professor in the Lakemont Physics Department. Ryan Holder just won the Pavia Award for his research contributions in the field of neuroscience. Daniela Vargas Dessen isn't a renowned Chicago artist, and she doesn't run a graphic design business. Her charmingly amateurish website displays several pieces of her best work and advertises her services as an art instructor. As I trudge up the stairwell to my third room floor, I finally begin to let myself believe. This is my world. I sit by the window of my hotel room, staring down at the blinking neon sign of Village Tap. I am not a violent person. I've never hit a man. Never even tried to. But if I want my family back, there's simply no way around it. I have to do a terrible thing. Have to do what Jason 2 did to me, only without the conscience-protecting option of simply putting him back into the box. Even though I have one ampule left, I wouldn't repeat his mistake. He should have killed me when he had the chance. I feel the physicist side of my brain creeping in, trying to take over the controls. I'm a scientist, after all, a process-minded thinker. So I think of this like a lab experiment. There's a result I want to achieve. What are the steps it will take for me to arrive at that result? First, define the desired result. Kill the Jason Dessen who's living in my home and put him in a place where no one will ever find him again. What tools do I need to accomplish that? A car. A gun. Some method of restraining him. A shovel. A safe place to dispose of his body. I hate these thoughts. Yes, he took my wife, my son, my life. But the idea of the preparation and the violence is so ugly. There's a forest preserve an hour south of Chicago. Kankakee River State Park. I've been there several times with Charlie and Daniela, usually in the fall when the leaves are turning and we're antsy for wilderness and solitude and a day out of the city. I could drive Jason 2 there at night, or make him drive, just like he did to me. lead him down one of the trails I know on the north side of the river. I will have been there a day or two prior, so his grave will already be dug in some quiet, secluded place. I'll have researched how deep to make it so animals can't smell the rot. Make him think he's going to dig his own grave, so he thinks he has more time to figure out an escape or to convince me not to do this. Then, when we're within 20 feet of the hole, I'll drop the shovel and say that it's time to start digging. As he bends down to pick it up, I'll do the thing I can't imagine. I will fire a bullet into the back of his head. Then I'll drag him over to the hole and roll him into it and cover him up with dirt. The good news is that no one will be looking for him. I'll slide back into his life the same way he slid into mine. Maybe, years down the road, I'll tell Daniela the truth. Maybe I'll never tell her. The sporting goods store is 3 blocks away and still an hour shy of closing. I used to come in here once a year to buy cleats and balls when Charlie was into soccer during middle school. Even then, the gun counter always held a fascination for me. A mystique. I could never imagine what would drive someone to want to own one. I've only fired a gun 2 or 3 times in my life while I was in high school in Iowa. Even then, shooting at rusted oil drums on my best friend's farm, I didn't experience the same thrill as the other kids. It scared me too much. As I would stand facing the target, aiming the heavy pistol, I couldn't escape the thought that I was holding death. The store is called Field and Glove, and I'm one of 3 customers at this late hour. Wandering past racks of windbreakers and a wall of running shoes, I make my way toward the counter at the back of the store. Shotguns and rifles hang on the wall over boxes of ammunition. Handguns gleam under glass at the counter. Black ones, chrome ones, ones with cylinders, ones without. Ones that look like they should only be carried by vigilante cops in 1970s action movies. A woman walks over wearing a black t-shirt and faded blue jeans. She's got a distinct Annie Oakley vibe with her frizzy red hair and a tattoo that wraps around her freckled right arm and reads, "The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed."
"Help you with something?" she asks.
"Yeah, I was looking to buy a handgun, but to be honest, I don't know the first thing about them."
"Why do you want one?"
"Home defense." She pulls a set of keys out of her pocket and unlocks the cabinet I'm standing in front of. I watch her arm reach under the glass and lift out a black pistol.
"So this is a Glock 23, 40 caliber, Austrian made. Solid knockdown power. I could also set you up in a subcompact version if you wanted something smaller for a concealed carry permit."
"And this will stop an intruder?"
"Oh yeah, this'll put them down and they won't be getting back up."
She pulls the slide, checks to make sure the tube is clear, and then locks it back and ejects the magazine. "How many bullets does it hold?"
13 rounds.
She offers me the gun. I'm not exactly sure what I'm supposed to do with it. Aim it? Feel the weight? I hold it awkwardly in my hand, and even though it isn't loaded, I register that same "I'm holding death" unease. The price tag hanging from the trigger guard reads $599.99. I need to figure out my money situation. I could probably walk into the bank and tap Charlie's savings account. It had a balance of around $4,000 the last time I looked. Charlie never accesses that account. No one does. If I withdrew a couple $1,000s, I doubt it would be missed. At least, not right away. Of course, I'd need to somehow get my hands on a driver's license first.
"What do you think of it?" she asks.
"Yeah, I mean, it feels like a gun."
"I could show you a few others. I have a really nice Smith & Wesson 357, if you were thinking more along the lines of a revolver."
"No, this would do fine. I just need to scrape together some cash. What's the background check process?"
"Do you have a FOID card?"
"What's that?"
"A firearm owner's identification card that's issued by the Illinois State Police. You have to apply for it.
How long does that take?
She doesn't answer. Just stares at me strangely. Then reaches out and takes the Glock from my hand and returns it to its resting place under the glass. I ask, did I say something wrong?
You're Jason, right?
How do you know my name?
I've been standing here trying to put it all together to make sure I wasn't crazy. You don't know my name?
No.
See, I think you're messing with me, and it's not a wise...
I've never spoken to you before. In fact, I haven't been in this store in probably 4 years. She locks the cabinet and returns the key ring to her pocket.
I think you should leave now, Jason.
I don't understand.
If this isn't some game, then you have a head injury or Alzheimer's, or you're just plain crazy.
What are you talking about?
You really don't know?
No. She leans her elbows on the counter.
2 days ago, you walked in here, said you wanted to buy a handgun. I showed you the same Glock. You said it was for home defense.
What does this mean? Is Jason, too, generally preparing in case I possibly return? Or is he actually expecting me? Did you sell me a gun? I ask.
No, you didn't have a FOID card. You said you needed to get cash. I don't think you even had a driver's license.
Now a prickling sensation trails down my spine. My knees go weak. She says,
and it wasn't just 2 days ago. I got a weird vibe from you, so yesterday I asked Gary, who also works the gun counter, if he'd ever seen you in here before. He had, 3 other times in the last week. And now, here you are again.
I brace myself against the counter.
So Jason, I don't ever want to see you in this store again, not even to buy a jockstrap. If I do, I'll call the police. Do you understand what I'm telling you?
She looks scared and resolute, and I would not want to cross her in a dark alley where she took me for a threat. I say, I understand.
Get out of my store.